Hey everyone, it's the Lady J. Thanks for joining me for another episode of I Never Told You What I Do For A Living. This week's episode features a hilarious discussion with a fellow podcaster, but this lovely human is from Ireland. I know Kevin as a fellow wrestling podcaster, but his career has spanned far and wide. This wonderful discussion covers topics of education, mental health, self-employment and freelancing, invisible fences, China, and his partner Joe's dead grandmother's house, and so much more. It is my absolute pleasure to introduce to you episode 30 of I Never Told You What I Do For A Living with Kevin, the polymath. All right. Good morning, Kevin. How are you?
I'm very, very well. Hey, we both managed to make it for morning. I'm very impressed with our scheduling here.
I know. This is great. I'm so awake right now. It's just shocking to me.
Yeah, but you're in the just woken up awake. I'm in the I've had my second cup of coffee because it's late morning awake. So, you know, we're in the two strongest forms of awake possible, I think.
And I also have my amazing morning radio voice on. So I'm really excited about that.
If it gets a little bit long in the tooth, we can switch to our drive time voices later on. if that sounds like it would be fun.
So I always start this podcast off with the same question, which is, what is your earliest childhood memory of what you wanted to be when you grew up?
Oh, God. I do remember very, very, very young wanting to do something involving kind of like comedy or cartoons, because I was one of those kids that, you know, drew really bad drawings, but they had lots of meaning and layers and depth and ongoing storylines and all that. So I just assumed like, well, once an actual animator sees my great stuff here, that'll be it. They'll just make it look nice and that's what I'll do. So I didn't realize that was an actual job, but I thought that's what I wanted to do. I think there was a long period of time I wanted to be, like in my early teens, I wanted to be a forensic scientist because I liked forensics and I liked science. And CSI was really tearing up the scene in the mid-2000s. So that was the first thing I can really think of where it's like, oh, that's a career that I would actually like to have. And like, you know, actually look and see, oh, these are the salaries and this is why it's impossible for you to do this in the country that you're in currently. But yeah, I think those are my earliest memories of actual jobs that I would have wanted to have done.
Did you feel like the adults in your life were encouraging you to pick some kind of career at a young age?
It's very difficult because I had like, this is the stupidest sentence ever. It's very difficult because I had very supportive parents and it's very hard, you know, but I had parents who were incredibly supportive in every respect. However, most of the things that they were supportive about with me were like not things that would be jobs. They would be things that they thought were just going to round me out, make me a good all round human being. But those things ended up actually becoming more like my job and stuff like that. My dad's a doctor. He's a GP in a teeny weeny village in Ireland. And he's just went in for his retirement. So he'll be finishing in 6 months. I think all throughout my childhood, I was doing things like, you know, drama classes. You know, I was encouraged to do, you know, debating. I did a clown workshop. You know, I did all this stuff that it was just like, hey, expose this child to the arts as much as possible. But anytime it was a discussion about what you would do, like it was going to be like, oh, well, I assume it'll be science or doctory thing or medical or something in inverted commas known as being proper. Because, you know, even though I'm involved in the world of media and stuff now, if I said to my parents probably when I was a teenager, hey, I want to do like radio or media studies, they would be like, no, there's no jobs in that. You won't do that. They would encourage me in the other way. They wouldn't have stopped me, I think. So like my parents ended up being like really instrumental in me being able to have the job I have now and do the things I do now because they provided me with a lot of opportunities. I think they were preparing me just to be a good person as opposed to a podcaster, which, I mean, yeah, if you got a kid, you want to become a podcaster, put him in drama and clown class. That'll definitely help. But we didn't know that in 1999, I guess.
Did they instill in you that education was important?
Yes, absolutely. I was reminded frequently about how special it was that my dad went to university and my mum she did go to university, but she didn't get to get a degree. She had like a diploma, and that was always kind of like a you know, she was not that she was saying like, oh, don't end up like me, but she was like, I've got a diploma and it's very important and I wish I had a degree and I don't have a degree because, you know, I had to start working and stuff like that. And our generation couldn't assumedly just go to university. It wasn't a given. Whereas your generation, it should be a given. So there was never any question that I wasn't going to go to university. My parents were always very pro education. And like, you know, I've got an uncle who's a lecturer at university. I've got an aunt who's a lecturer in women's studies as well. So, you know, I had a lot of kind of academics in my extended family, I guess. And, you know, when you've got like a highfalutin auntie who's, you know, a professor of women's studies and a highfalutin uncle who's doing like philosophy and stuff, it does make academia seem quite glamorous. And while I'm very grateful that I had a, you know, good relationship with education, I viewed it in a positive way. You know, I think it did make me have quite lofty expectations about what the academic world was like, because I did have a job in academia for a brief period and it was a miserable experience and not the cool, jazzy time I thought it would be growing up.
What was school like for you when you were younger?
So primary school, or elementary school, as you would probably call it in your neck of the world, that was in a small village. And it was, you know, I think in my entire school, there were 60 kids, which for me seems like at the time it was the most normal thing in the world. And like, you know, I know people who are teachers who teach classes that have nearly 60 kids in them now, never mind the whole school. To think we had all, you know, 8 grades or whatever, as you would call them, in one little school was something else. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, it was a bit weird because I was in that kind of gray area in Ireland where kids still got hit in school, even though they weren't meant to. And it was kind of like the thing where like, well, one of the teachers is in her 20s, so she won't hit you. But one of the teachers is in her 70s and no one's going to tell her to not hit you. So there was like, I mean, I didn't get hit that much as my memory recollects, but I had to see a lot of kids get whacked the fuck up. And they, like the old teacher who hit kids, she was also the teacher of the youngest class. So my memories of seeing kids get hit in school was mostly between the ages of 4 and 7, which is pretty messed up when I think about it now. Like I had a ruler I was given for my birthday broken over another student's hands because they had spoken out of turn or whatever. I had cut a few switches for teachers in my time, which is kind of something a 90s kid wouldn't expect to do, you know? So early memories of like primary school are mostly positive, except looking back, that's a bit weird. Secondary school for me was a whole different kettle of fish. I'm sure anyone who's listened to my podcast know that I went to boarding school. I went to Catholic all-boys boarding school, which as I was progressing through my years in what would be high school, I was the last year of students who were boarding students. So when other people would have been there, it would have been like 6 grades of people who were all in boarding school, like 200-300 people or whatever. When I was there, my first year, 200-300 people. Second year, like 170 people. In my final year, there were 18 of us in a boarding house designed for 300 students. And it was creepy as fuck. So yeah, I have a lot of like, I mean, you can imagine going to a Catholic all-boys boarding school isn't an ideal place to kind of learn your adolescence and grow up and whatnot. So I do look back on it with kind of mixed feelings. I met good friends. I had great teachers. I think it taught me a lot of grit and thing. You know, I got a lot of determination. I'm a soft boy, but any determination I have came from being in boarding school and having to kind of fend for myself, really, because there were older students and there was a lot of bullying and there was a lot of racism and, you know, there was a lot of weird stuff. I mean, I'm very grateful for being in the school I was in because it had a big international element. So a lot of my classmates in boarding school were from, you know, Nigeria, Germany. I had a friend who was from the Basque country. I had a friend from South Korea. So I got quite interested in like the world and I became a bit of a globalist, I guess, quite early on as a result of that, because I got to hang out and chat with a lot of people from a lot of different parts of the world, some of whom were very lovely.
Was there a clear trajectory for you when you were in school of where you felt you were going to go? I mean, it sounds like from the family that you grew up in that university was like a thing that was going to happen unless something else came along like out of left field.
Yeah, I mean, I think university was not, it was a definite, yes, you are going to university. Like, and that wasn't as if I was had to be pushed or even, like, we never even had to have a chat of, like, do you want to go to university? Like, I never even questioned myself at any point, would I actually want to go to university? And I have a lot of friends who kind of would have been, you know, they're a bit younger than me, so they would have went through university later than me. And I have a lot of friends who kind of would say in retrospect, like, oh, I shouldn't have went to university because I got in debt and I didn't need it. And what I do now, my degree is not relevant to. I'm one of the fortunate people who got to go to university for free, because in Ireland, university is free, except for fees, except for registration fees, which I think now are like $2,000 or $3,000. Whereas when I started, it was like $200 or $300. So it was kind of low risk for me to go to university. I went to university in Galway, where a lot of my family was from anyway. So it was kind of like something I was really looking forward to, going to this cool town, getting away from this horrible boarding school, having that level of freedom after being kind of on lockdown for a long time. That really was my trajectory. All along, I was really kind of salivating at the thought of getting out of boarding school and getting to live in cool Galway town. But I mean, trajectory in terms of what I thought it would be, I'll do a sciencey degree that will get me into forensics, and then I'll become, you know, the Gus Grissom of the west of Ireland. But it obviously didn't end out that way. I like, within my first 2 days, I think, of university, I realized I didn't want to do forensics, and I fell in love with zoology instead. So quickly my kind of focus shifted, and I became insanely interested in animals and the world of evolution and classification. So I kind of decided, right, I'm gonna aim towards being a researcher, trying to get a job in this field where if you type zoology into any job listing, it'll say, sorry, please get another degree. So that was my trajectory, I guess, at the time.
Did you, like, were you taking a class in it? How does someone just fall into zoology?
I will say there was one person who did it absolutely resolutely. There was, I'd say, a week where we had like lectures from kind of everyone from across all the departments, like microbiology, biochemistry. Everyone would come in and kind of say, you're going to do a little bit with me this year. Here's a taste of it. And if you like it, you can do this subject for your degree. And I was getting really kind of worried because anatomy was really boring and the physiology was really hard. And these, like, anatomy and physiology, those are like the things you needed for forensics. And like, I was struggling with physics as well, which I knew would be a big part of any forensics specialization. And then Professor Wallace Arthur came in and he spent around 50 minutes saying that he had a new book out and that you should probably go buy it because reading his book would be better than going to his lectures. And he was your absolute typical old man professor emeritus who described himself as being a bit of a maverick, and a maverick in such that he told 300 first years to buy his book. And I did buy his book, and his book absolutely gripped me. It was called Creatures of Accident. I thought he was charismatic, and he made his love of zoology very evident and why it is something to be loved and appreciated. And I come from a debating background as well. I'm a bit of an ornery kid. I was an ornery kid. I'm now an ornery 32-year-old man. So I liked the idea of getting into something where there were points of view to be argued. I felt very strongly about people like Richard Dawkins and stuff like that, that I felt like that he was doing a lot of harm at the time. Because, you know, 2006 and 7, the atheist movement and the God delusion, a lot of this was coming out into kind of the mainstream. And there was a lot of toxic discourse with, you know, atheists and skeptics and whatnot. And I always viewed myself as a skeptic, but I thought, wow, here's this guy, Wallace Arthur, who's brave enough to say, I disagree with some people like Richard Dawkins, but here are some of my theories and here are some of the things we don't know yet. And I found his openness, and I found his kind of like ability to show that zoology was so much more than just animals and evolution. It really gripped me. So yeah, I was one of those stupid kids who kind of like fell in love with his professor and then hitched his wagon to it. But I absolutely do not regret it, because 4 years later, I was doing, you know, behavioral experiments involving coastal centipedes with the man, and I had a great time doing it. So yeah, no regrets on that end.
What else did you get out of university besides your degree?
I got a lot of great friends, some of which I'm unfortunately not really in great contact with anymore, because I am an emigrant. Therefore, I've kind of have struggled to keep in touch with my friends, particularly as they've moved further afield. I would say the most important thing for me right now in terms of my job and what I do, I volunteered at the student radio station Flirt FM, and I did it on a whim because my brother had done it before me, and I thought, oh, I'll carry on the Mahon broadcasting legacy and, you know, hitch my tent in there. And I was really kind of worried when I first went to uni, because I had been someone who'd filled his days and hours with, you know, drama and, you know, debating and comedy. And these are all these little things that I got involved with. I tried to do as many different activities as possible. I joined the drama society, and it was the most miserable 3 months of my life. The people were horrible. They were so cruel to each other. And I went and I joined the stand-up comedy society, and like we'd all sit around and like, let's tell each other our jokes, and then people would like not laugh at each other's jokes because they didn't like each other and they didn't want them to give them the satisfaction and think that their jokes were good. So everyone just sat around kind of no selling each other's work and kind of making everyone feel awkward. And I'm like, why would I want to? Like, I was really distressed. So I thought, I'll just go and do radio. That'll be fine. I did a comedy show for a year called Filler, spelled with a PH. And that was my sarcastic reaction to be put on at 3:30 in the afternoon on a Monday, which is definitely the filler slot. And, you know, I got to meet some cool people. We did some stuff. Summer came around. All the people went back home. I hung around like a bad smell. And then I was given my own 2-hour live radio show on a Monday night called The Black Lodge, where I played music, did weird comedy, probably broke a million community radio broadcasting guidelines, a lot of accidental swearing and apologies for accidental swearing, lots of, you know, I learned how to do things like edit, you know, that's like, I went in one day and it's like, here's Adobe Audition, learn how to use this. And I thought, well, what am I going to use this for? Well, now it's my job and it's my livelihood. So thank you very much, Paula Healy and Louise Clark, the station managers who were in student radio. And I would say anyone who has a community or student radio station near them, take part, volunteer, do what you can, because those are vital, vital sources, I think, of knowledge and experience. And the other important thing I did was I was part of a group of people who, you know, I mentioned a lot of bad times with societies, and some of our friends, we were looking into the kind of the funding and the setup of societies in our university. And we were like, this is ridiculous. Like, if you're a society and you have 100 members, you're entitled to 300 quid to have a one-off party every year, because we're living in the Celtic Tiger. The financial crash hasn't happened and no one knows the value of money at the moment. So we formed the Nothing Specific Society with the sole purpose at the time, which was we would form a society with no actual intent to do anything, or anything specific at least. And we would then reap the benefits of having all of the kind of rewards that you get for running a society. And we gave out free paper hats, and we did it despite a lot of the societies, like the Debate Society and the Drama Society, where we had all the bad experiences. We gave out free paper hats on the day, and we broke the record for signups for a university society in NUI Galway. We got nearly 1,000 people signed up on our first day. We ran out of newspapers to make hats out of. And we spent the next 3 years. I don't want people to think I was being really cynical, like, oh, we're going to take all the money. No, we actually spent the next 3 years then planning non-specific events. We would do things like randomly on the spur of the moment, just to provide a bit of brevity for people who are, you know, in university and didn't want to join in with all that society. Because societies can be very clicky, and we just didn't want it to be like that. We just were like, hey, if you want to help us organize stuff, you can. If you just want to come out and play human Pac-Man with us, or do a rock, paper, scissors competition, or join our ice cream social, or go to the top of the physics building and do a paper airplane contest with us, or do a Where's Wally contest where we dress up 4 people from our society as members of Where's Wally, but then someone accidentally dressed like Where's Wally and Wendy and didn't realize, and then they get loads of people coming up to them asking them if they're Wally. Like, lots of fun stuff like that. So that was the most kind of fun thing, because I was interviewing for PhDs when I left university, and I've got papers published under my name. I've done lots of research and interesting things. I spent time in China working with bears, and every single time I was in an interview for a job, they'd go, Nothing Specific Society, what's that? Tell me about that. It got me more jobs than my degree did in science at the Nothing Specific Society. And I have a lot of love in my heart for that, because I think it showed me that you and a few friends, you can just go fuck it and do a thing. And I think that kind of attitude helped me with podcasting later on in life.
So what did you do after college, or university, I should say?
After university, I went to Glasgow. The idea being, because my brother lived in Edinburgh, and I thought, oh, I'll go to Glasgow for a year. I'll get my master's, because I'd saved up some money from working in a shoe shop. I'll get my master's, and then I'll smooth sailing back into Ireland with the great degree, and I'll have a master's, and I'll go back and I'll become a researcher and get a great job and live the dream and all that. So it kind of worked out not exactly like that, because around 6 months into me being in Glasgow doing my master's, in which I had a great time doing, a great university, the University of Glasgow, and a great city as well. I have a lot of love for Scotland as a result of my year there. But 6 months in, Ireland got bailed out by the International Monetary Fund, and under quite harsh terms, let's just say. And I remember it was like around the time of my birthday, sitting in my poorly furnished room thinking, I'm going to be going home in a few months. and watching the Taoiseach, the Prime Minister of the country, saying, pretty much there's no more money now. We're going to be through real harsh austerity for the foreseeable future. I remember ringing up my mom and dad and like being in tears when my mom said, you're not coming home. There's no jobs for you. You'll end up living here and we'll all get sick of each other, which seemed really harsh at the time. But she was absolutely true, because a lot of my friends just said, like, fuck it, I'm going back home. And then they spent 4 years unemployed, you know. So I made the scary decision after I came back from China. I thought, right, I'll try apply for jobs and PhDs here in the UK, hopefully Scotland if I can swing it. Spent 3 months going through the remaining of my savings, extending my lease month by month in an apartment I could not afford, failing every interview I had. I had a job interview at the Charles Darwin building in London, and they asked, what's your weakness, Kevin? I don't know why I said, I'm really bullheaded, mate. I don't know why I said that straight away. They're like, yeah, get out of here. Back on the train to Glasgow, you fucking idiot. Like, oh, me, I'm awful, me. Oh, don't hire me. So I ended up applying for a PhD. Well, it was a research position that could turn into a PhD at the University of Lincoln. I thought it was a Lincoln, Nebraska. I didn't realize there was a Lincoln in the United Kingdom. Went down there, did the PhD interview. Fucked it up, didn't do a good job. I got really heartbroken when I went there, because there was two places and there was around 40 people, most of which were in their 30s and had very impressive careers ahead of them. So I felt, I've got nothing going for me here. I mean, like, I'd done some cool research and I'd been to some cool places, but I didn't have a career. So I thought, there's no way. Then 2 months later, a crazy millionaire who was obsessed with cats gave the same school a whole bunch of money because she kept her cats safe, in inverted commas, with an electronic containment fence. And there have been moves in Wales to make those illegal. The idea is that it's an invisible fence. You may have them in America, I believe, mm-hmm. where a cat or a dog will wear a collar. There's a wire underneath the property. If they approach the wire, they get a beep, 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 warning them, which they've been trained to recognize with an electric shock, a mild shock. So if they cross the boundary and they leave the property, they get zapped. And people were like, this is horrible. Other people were like, no, because 300,000 cats get run over a year in the UK. This is necessary to keep cats safe. So enter me, who was given the job of trying to assess the entire country's attitudes towards wandering cats, and then to do a series of experiments to determine whether or not those electronic containment fences were harmful or not. I spent 2 years making a ridiculously large survey that I think got like 10,000 responses from cat owners and non-cat owners. I had to go through every one where people are like, I'll kill a cat if I see it, mate. You know, loads of great stuff like that. I had to speak to a lot of horrible and a lot of nice people doing this survey. And I had two supervisors who hated each other. One who was in charge of the kind of the experiments with the fence, one who was in charge of the survey. And the survey went well. It was meant to be over in 6 months. And then it was like, this survey is great. Why don't you expand it? And I did. And then I expanded it again and then again and again. And I had the feeling that my supervisor thought, oh, we're going to get like 3 or 4 papers out of this. And before I'd known it, I'd spent 2 years out of a 3.5-year funded position doing something that was meant to take me 6 months, while my other supervisor was kind of going, well, he wants you to do it, so I guess we can't do our thing yet. And I felt I was caught between like an office feud. And I had a little bit of a mental breakdown, for lack of a better term, as I realized I was probably going to run out of funding before I'd be able to actually do the meat of the project, because I was meant to be there to test these fences. And all I had been doing was testing people's attitudes to the fences, which, surprise, surprise, were very negative. And I felt I was like, didn't know what to do with myself. And I was like, I was doing stand-up at the time and I was doing some radio at the time. I met Adam Bibelow, Sam Chaplin, Billy Keeble, all the people I podcast with now. And I was doing a lot of side hustles to kind of keep me going. And those side hustles, I didn't realize those were like the only thing that was getting me to wake up in the morning. You know, those were the only things that were actually giving me any joy, because my job was making me depressed and miserable. And I was doing a stand-up routine where I would do 5 minutes about who, you know, I'm going to get a PhD in cats so I could be a doctor. And I'd be like, you know, so someone at a party goes, is there a doctor in the house? And I go, yes, my husband is choking. Is he a cat? Yes. Well, I'm not a vet. I'm only a behavioral specialist in certain patterns of society. So, you know, I was already realizing that I was going on a career route that I think was going to make me even more unemployable somehow. So I made the gracious decision after I had what's called an MPhil transfer, which is basically to say, have you done enough work here that we could in a year or two qualify you as a PhD candidate and give you a doctorate. And I passed that. And then after I passed it, I was meant to go and present my findings at a conference. And I woke up one morning crying and I had to ring him and say, look, I can't do this anymore. I'm sorry. It was really awkward because one of the supervisors did not accept that I was having a mental break and I was having a difficulty. So he just wanted me to get on a plane and go present his findings, which I was not going to do. It was awkward. I had to be escorted out by security. I had to return my laptop and my trap cams for monitoring cats and things like that. I had to do that with security as well, like I was going to rip the place up. But I hold absolutely no ill will about it, because other than that one person who I had difficulty with, that supervisor, I had a great experience. I had freedom to kind of pursue other interests. I got to be on the BBC on a special cat documentary, which I get tweeted about every other week still. So yeah, I was very fortunate and I have no ill will whatsoever. You know, if I'd stayed there, I think I would have been the person with ill will. I didn't want to be bitter Dr. Mahon with a degree in something he hated. So instead, I'm, you know, non-bitter Kevin who has a master's and had 2 years in Lincoln where I met the best people. I met Joanna in Lincoln, my partner, and, you know, we've been together 6 years. My life would not be what it is if had I not taken that stop in Lincolnshire. So I'm very happy that I did it. And it was a weird, wild time, you know. Infinite stories have come from my 2 years spent as a cat behavioral researcher.
I think it's really insightful of you that you realize what was happening internally, though, with yourself, and that you spoke up, because I think a lot of people were kind of programmed to, and for some people, it's 100% true, and I don't want to dispel that for anyone. We're kind of programmed to think, as long as you're getting a paycheck, you should be grateful. Yeah. And
yes, yeah.
And whatever's happening in your brain, like, you need to deal with that separately. And sometimes it's like, no, sometimes the two things are directly related. And the only way to get into a healthier headspace is to leave the job, which is very scary and can be very financially debilitating. But it's a leap that some people just need to take.
I think the only reason I was brave enough to do it, I mean, I don't even know if it was brave, but it's just the fact that, like, I was in a different country. So for me, it's kind of like, you know, I didn't want to go home with my tail between my legs. So, you know, I really felt strongly that if I went home kind of in a year's time where I was like, you know, I'd used up all the funding and I had nothing to show for it, I thought I might as well leave now where I've done work that I'm proud of. And if they want to do stuff with my work, they can. I've never checked to see if they ever, you know, I could have a published paper out there under my name about cats, who knows? But, you know, it really helped that I just kind of, I had other things to do. And I certainly wasn't thinking at the time, Ara, sure, I'll go and I'll podcast. You know, I was podcasting at the time. I think there was like 7 episodes of the SGR podcast at that point. I had just been to Edinburgh to do my Fringe Festival show with Sam and a few other people. So I got a lot of things going in my mind. And I think I had convinced myself that that was okay and enough. Looking back now, if I was to advise myself, it would have been like, you're giving up a paycheck and you're like, you have nothing to show for it now. You know, I ended up being a mailman for a brief period of time. I ended up working in, like, you know, as a cold caller. I did a lot of weird, shitty jobs in the time. I spent a summer when I met Joe designing resources for kindergarten students who are being tutored at home. So I had to make like ABC grids with like goblins and ghouls on them and stuff. It was, you know, it was an odd time. It really got me in the headspace of a freelancer. I became a proper hustler during that time, because it's like, right, there's a loaf of bread and a pack of Easy Singles in the fridge and you have no money in the bank. Go get a job, Kevin, because otherwise you have to emigrate back home and I'm not doing that. So yeah, it really lit a fire underneath me. And I think it's not a given that everyone's going to have that fire. If I wasn't someone in his early 20s who was very terrified about becoming too old to do anything and was ashamed to go home, I don't know if I would have made it through that time. And if I didn't have the friends that I mentioned as well, those, like, I mean, I had Adam Biblow as a housemate at the time, and that guy is solid as a rock. Like, I depended on him so much during that time. And yeah, I mean, when I met Joanna, it's like, hi, I'm Kevin. I do a podcast and I don't have a job and I don't know what I'm doing with my life. I've got prospects. You know, it was great, like, having people who kind of understood my position and kind of, you know, I think people understood my position more when I lost my job than when I actually was doing my job, if that makes sense.
What was the first podcast you ever listened to?
The first podcast I ever listened to, Oh, that's going to be a tough one now. It's probably going to be Colt Cabana's The Art of Wrestling or the On Cinema podcast from Tim Heidecker and Greg Turkington, which went on to become a web series and a whole other bunch of things.
I feel like those are some pretty, not to downplay the importance of those things for you, but I feel like those are very common answers. Because I feel like Colt Cabana's podcast has been around since the earth cooled, basically.
Live to you from the studio Primordial Soup in Chicago, Illinois. I mean, I've spent a large part of my podcasting career putting over Colt Cabana, and I'll happily do so until the end of time. It's been stated so many times, everyone's sick of hearing it, but like, yeah, that podcast changed a lot of lives, myself included, you know? I didn't really think much of podcasting as a format really back in the day. It was really when I was that period of time where I was a postman and I started kind of, you know, stomping around and, you know, had a 3-4 hours on my feet at a time where I had to just, you know, keep myself entertained. I listened to a lot of Stone Cold podcasts, a lot of Chris Jericho, a lot of, you know, a lot of these ones when they were first starting out, all those kind of original Podcast One groups. And I will say it as well, for me, it was just as important to listen to podcasts that I hated or had difficulty with or disagreed with than it was to listen to ones that I thought were great. Because I listened to a lot of podcasts. I'm not going to mention them now because I don't want to just go like burying people. But like there are a lot of podcasts I listen to and I would be thinking there going, wow, is this like the standard that's out there? Because a lot of podcasts, you know, that were for wrestling seemed really mean. They seemed kind of narrow-minded and they all seemed to be like, hey, here's three people with the exact same viewpoint, or four people with the exact same viewpoint. The only difference is the quality of their microphones. Spoiler, it's all bad. And I was just saying all these things I was listening to, and I was kind of like, you know, I was building up in my mind this whole time. I didn't realize I was kind of like cataloging all the stuff I liked and disliked about podcasts at the time. But when it came time to actually record a podcast, I was like, had all this stuff kind of come out, had all these ideas straight away. It's because I had been listening for like a year solid and I'd kind of absorbed all the stuff that I liked and didn't like.
Do you still do that when you listen to podcasts? Because I definitely feel like I still do that thing where I'm kind of listening to things and going like, do I like this? Do I not like this? Why don't I like this? What would I do differently? Like, that's just a constant thing.
Yeah, I mean, my podcast listening these days, I mean, I have so much audio that I have to get through. And I have so much audio to record. I would be lying if I said the majority of stuff I listen to isn't our own stuff, or like listening back to stuff that other people have edited that I'm just giving a second pass through. So, you know, the last thing I usually want to do when I'm finished at the end of the day is like listen to another wrestling podcast that I might not enjoy as much. I try and catch stuff, you know, big episodes of things here and there. I still listen to Colt Cabana and I'll still listen to kind of a lot of wrestling news stuff just so I kind of have enough knowledge myself to kind of continue on and be able to do my job correctly. So I wouldn't say I do that as much anymore, but that's because I've kind of jettisoned a lot of my actual audio listening, because I learned quite early doing this job that if I'm to continue doing it at a level that I'm happy with and that fans will be happy with, that I can't fill my free time doing the same thing. Like back in the day, I filled my free time doing my side hustle. Now my side hustle is my job. If I spend my free time doing that, I end up working all day. And that's not good for anyone, because you'll get sick of anything if you do it 12 hours a day and you don't have work time and recreation time. And that was really hard for me. I had to be tapped on the shoulder a few times and say, Kevin, it's 8 o'clock at night. Do you really need to watch 97 Raw? I'm like, yes, but no, but yes, you know?
So what was the wrestling podcast was the first one?
The Attitude Era podcast was the first podcast, yeah.
Okay.
That we had done, yeah.
And what was that experience like?
Well, it started because I was getting kind of itchy feet not having done student radio in a while. And, you know, I'd done 2 hours live a week every week for 4 years and a half hour film review show every Friday as well. So, like, I was used to recording a lot of stuff and just being on the air, and I really missed it. And at the University of Lincoln, there were two radio stations, one of which was like kind of the official one, which was run by an old man who really didn't know what the fuck he was doing. And was just trying to make like BBC Radio 4 with 19-year-old students presenting it. It's like, you've got the wrong atmosphere here, friend. And then there was another one set up called Brayford Radio. And it was going to be like, this is by students for students. And we knew some of the people who were running it, because I knew a lot of people involved in the media productions school. And I was like, hey, Adam, do you want to be me and Billy's producer? Because me and Billy were doing stand-up comedy at the time. Like, let's just make a show. And the show was called Radio Cart 64. And we were just going to, like, be stupid and make jokes and play some music, but mostly just kind of, you know, play, like, exaggerated versions of ourselves, a lot of, like, kind of fake arguments and things like that. It was just going to be a platform for us to have some fun. Adam ended up being, like, Roz, essentially, in Frasier, where he chipped in so much he was part of the show. It became a three-person show. But the student radio station was very badly run. There was three times where we'd record an episode and we were like, lads, that was a blinder. You know, high fives. That was so much fun. You know, tears of laughter. And then we come out and go, oh, guys, sorry. Turns out we didn't have the aerial turned on, so no one heard it. But you recorded it, right? No. Why didn't you stop us when we were like sweating profusely? Well, you seemed like you were having a good time. So we were like, screw it. Let's stop this. And I was like, let's do a podcast instead, guys. And I, over a weekend, was like, right, let's do Attitude Era podcast, because there's like, you know, OSW review, they review like the Hogan era. And we had been playing a lot of like wrestling games around the time. And I knew that like Adam and Billy had different knowledge to wrestling compared to me. And I thought this would be really interesting. We go through this. Billy's not seen any of it. Adam's seen some of it. I've seen all of it. I know we have good interplay and it will be funny if we are able to do it. And that's literally it. We just, on a whim, started recording. First episode recorded in Adam's bedroom. Dreadfully boring. Dreadfully bad affair. Second episode, I think we felt we could make some jokes. And then I think by episode three, we had people who were like, kind of, hey, I run a podcast network. Would you like to give me your podcast? And we were like, oh my God, can you believe it? We're going to get on TMW PGJ News or whatever stupid thing it was. And we were like, no, let's cooler jets. We know that there's interest, but let's just try and keep making a show and not just, you know, hitch our wagon to the first horse who saunters on by. We got some interplay with Inside the Ropes very early on. They distributed our podcast. Kenny was really, really great in helping out. He even helped flyer my Edinburgh show with Sam Chaplin, which was really great. And then after that, it was Matthew from Botchamania. He just DM'd me one night and he's like, hey, hear people like your podcast. You want to host it on the site? And yeah, those two things together helped us kind of get a big signal boost. We were kind of gaining a lot of momentum, and I think we would have gotten our audience eventually, I think, you know, a significant audience, because we were getting, you know, a couple of hundred, then a couple of thousand plays by episode two or three. But those two kind of big wheels stepping in to help us out, and that was really appreciated, because that really just got us out in front of a lot of people really quickly. And I appreciate a lot of people who helped out, you know, setting up the podcast at the time. A lot of great, you know, feedback and advice from the guys from OSW. There were a lot of people who were, you know, still followers and fans on Twitter today who just like were early kind of cheerleaders for us. And it really helped, you know, it really was something that came together rather quickly. And I 100% accept that it only happened because of when it happened. If we tried to do that right now in the current saturated market, it would not work at all.
So two things. First of all, I'm going to start a society of people who come on this podcast and got started in podcasting from college radio, because
yeah,
there is a not insignificant, I mean, I am part of that as well. So I just, it's always funny when I hear people talking about how college radio prepared them. And I'm like, yep, we all learned Adobe Audition together. And then we got into podcasting at the same time.
We all knew the hard limits, you know?
Yep, exactly. Why isn't somebody called a podcast the Hard Limits? That's
I know,
really,
right? That'd be a great name for a tag team as well, actually. The Hard Limits.
Yes. So when did you and Joanna start podcasting together?
Oh, let's see. So I met Joanna this May, it'll be 6 years. And I met Joanna on OK Cupid, and we started going out pretty quickly. Like, I think it was within 2 months of meeting, we were kind of boyfriend and girlfriend, if, you know, properly at least. And I think it was 2015. So I think by that, we met in like kind of May. And I think by that August, we were thinking about podcasting. And like, honestly, one of the things that me and Joe talked about a lot is because Joe was working in digital media at the time. She was working at a publisher's company, which was like a lot of old brick and mortar, you know, type of, they did like magazines about trains, magazines about kitchens, magazines about gardens. And Joe was part of like a grant that was like, how can we help these guys pivot to the new digital age. So Joe was interested in things like podcasts and YouTube videos and things like that. So, you know, at the start, we ended up talking about podcasting a whole lot. And I didn't want to talk about it at all because I didn't want to be the guy like, hey, baby, it's me, the guy with glasses and a beard you met online who's going to tell you about his wrestling podcast. You know, it was it was nothing to really talk or brag about at the time. So Joe, I was actually really surprised, was kind of quite, I don't want to say prying, but she was very eager to know everything about it because she was like looking at it going, like, you've got like, you know, 6,000 plays for these, you know, these episodes are coming out every week, and then now it's gone up to 20,000 plays. You know, you've made money from it. You know, you guys are doing it all independently. You don't have sponsors. You don't have, you know, ads. Like, you, this is literally 100% DIY, you know, all on your own backs. And she was really fascinated because everything she had read in the podcast media, in inverted commas, which, by the way, most of the stuff and expertise that's out there is from people who have failed to make a podcast. And I think it's worth saying a lot of the, hey, guide to being the best podcaster. How have they gotten on in the iTunes rankings is a matter of interest, because there's a lot of crappy info out there. And this, I think, you know, rang true to Joe because my real life experience is a lot different to what she was reading and in hearing at conferences and all that. So I think it was probably, you know, quite soon we were thinking about the idea. And I think, we already had Cinema Swirl, which I knew was a format that really worked, where Sam hadn't seen any of the movies and I had, and that kind of interplay led for a lot of really interesting discussions and a lot of humor. And I thought, well, Joe's got kind of, you know, Joe's got the mindset of someone who's never watched wrestling before at all. And she's got, you know, strong values, and she's educated. She knows how to handle herself in a discussion or an argument. So I thought, well, dipping into the really weird world of wrestling, I think it wouldn't necessarily be just like a comedy podcast, but we were thinking it could be something that was fun and lighthearted and make wrestling accessible, but also maybe we could have more of a serious discussion that wasn't just with wrestling fans about some of the problems and some of the great things about wrestling that, you know, outsiders might not know about. So I think kind of the idea was ruminating for a while, and then we had a trip to Cambridge, and then the idea was kind of solidified and we started recording soon enough after that. And I think it was a lot different starting a podcast with Joanna compared to when me and Sam did it, or me, Adam and Billy did it, where we were like, let's just go throw something up against a wall and see what happens. And obviously the format has changed a bit, its tone has changed a bit. I think we're a lot different podcasts now than we were when we started. But like, Joe was so amazing because she had all these great ideas about how to like engage people on social media, because we knew that like people liked caption contests and things, but the idea to actually have people's opinions on wrestlers or parts of wrestling be the actual foundation of the whole discussion, that was like her idea. And I thought that was like what made the podcast have something really unique. And I still think it does have something really unique about it, as opposed to a lot of other podcasts that are kind of a bit closed off. And I wanted to include the wider voices, because I don't want to be the person who just assumes that his opinion is the correct one. And very often fans' opinions will be different from mine and different from Joanna's opinions. So that's kind of like, that's how the podcast came together. And, you know, it's Joe's baby. You know, she's looked after it. She's helped that idea kind of ruminate and develop. And I think the podcast is what it is now because of Joe's work and her input. She's really made it something different and something special.
But you do more than just podcasting now.
I mean, I have three podcasts which have three patrons that all have, you know, things to fulfill. So I spend the vast majority of my time recording, editing, you know, listening back, editing again, releasing, social media, meetings with Adam and meetings with Joe, just, you know, getting her strategies out and all this. So that takes up a lot of my time. But on the side as well, yeah, I do every which thing I can. I do modeling, I do extras work, I do acting, I do corporate work, I do presenting. I like the idea because, you know, for instance, I'm in season 3, episode 6 of Man Down, the comedy series on Channel 4, and I just show up there, you know, and I just show up in that BBC documentary as well. And I like the idea of just showing up on people's timelines, because if you know who I am, I'm a bit of a weird presence. And if you don't know who I am, I'm also a bit of a weird presence, I think. And I just love the idea. Like, I did a thing recently, Jay, where I was part of like a Bandersnatch style interactive video training for NHS mental health staff and nurses here in the UK. So basically, you watch a video when you're training, and it's like, how can we minimize, you know, aggression and physicality between inmates who are maybe, you know, who are dealing with, you know, strong violent urges and stuff like that. And I played one of the baddies who was like causing problems, stealing shirts and winding everyone up and telling them their mum can't come visit. So I played the villain of the interactive Bandersnatch multiple choice NHS mental health staff training. And just the idea to me, Jay, of someone going in for their first day of training, and then I show up in the background nicking a Johnny Cash t-shirt, which then they have to react to quickly. It fills me, I'm not sure it fills me with joy. It fills me with something, though. It certainly fills a hole in my heart. I've been doing like weird videos for Bargain Booze, who are a chain of like corner shops here in the UK recently as well. I just when you're a podcaster, you got to get out of the goddamn house. And I've been doing this coming up on 4 years soon. And I learned very quickly within 6 months that I got to get out of the house and I got to go meet people and I got to live my life. I got to do stuff because so much of my podcast is based on my life experience and what I've seen, what I've done and who I am. And I don't want to become like a boring, you know, a boring drooling person who just sits in listening to wrestling and talking about wrestling all day. I have to go out and live my life. I have to go out and experience the world. And I just want to go out and like, you know, on the Raz or on the Tear or anything like that. I'm not a big party or a big social guy. So I want to go out and work and do some interesting things and meet some interesting people. And yeah, if anything, this COVID-19 has just made me realize how much I appreciate all of my side hustles, because not being able to get out of the house at all, even though my life is kind of mostly unchanged compared to the distress people are going through, I am really kind of getting a bit itchy now. Like, I was meant to be going out doing a space show, and I really wish I was going to do my space show this week. They were going to join up my two scars together to make a big scar on my head, and I'm not going to get it happen now for ages.
That I couldn't even recreate the sentence that you just put together if I wanted to under different circumstances.
That was the sentence?
Well, the end of that about what you were going out to do a space show and that they were going to bring your two scars together. That's, I've never, what?
I know. Well, I've many scars, you see. My head is covered in scars. I had a bit of a bumpy childhood in terms of accidents and older brothers and other accidents. So I've got a quite a noticeable large scar on my right eyebrow, and I also have one on the right hand side of my temple. So when I was being put in through makeup, because I'm playing kind of a dirty, dusty fighting character in the background, they're like, oh, okay, we're going to join up these two scars together and give you a really big scar. Would you like that? And I go, yes, please. I would like a... I would very much feel I could process my scars by having a kind of a fictionalized version of it on my face for an afternoon.
How did you get, did you, the things that you do outside of the house, were they things that you saw like a casting call for, or was it recommended, somebody recommended you for the role, or?
It's any which way, you know, if I see something advertised online, I'll apply. If I see someone asking for something on Twitter, I'll apply. If anyone, you know, mentions anything to me, I'll apply. If I've worked with someone in the past, even briefly doing a thing, like I worked with like Logitech and Sky doing a weird video for them recently. Like anyone who I've worked with in the past, I'll email every like 2 or 3 weeks and say, hey, I'm free this week. Anything going? You know, any work going? Any projects? So it is. Oh, I have to be my own agent. You know, I don't have one. I don't know if I need one or if I can get one. So it is all just like pure grind on the hustle. You know, every morning I will check my emails and I'll check any other kind of opportunities in the area, so to speak. Because yeah, I just think it's good for me as well. I think because I don't want to get complacent ever. I don't want to get out of the headspace that I need to kind of like, you know, I never want to take like my backers on Patreon for granted, just kind of think, oh, that'll always be there. You know, I just want to make sure that I'm always in the headspace of, you know, looking for work, because that's a good headspace to be in, to just be kind of active and not resting on your laurels and assessing your qualities and assessing what you can and can't do and having an interplay, negotiating rates and fees. That's something that I've learned so much about from doing these side hustles. I'll always remember my dad growing up, now and then, like every 2 or 3 months, he'd disappear for a day and go, Dad, where are you going? He's like, oh, I'm just going down to interview for a job in Dublin. They go, why are you doing that? We live here in the middle of nowhere. Why would you go there? And he goes, son, you'll realize this someday, but you need to do these things to keep yourself sharp. And I found out later, my dad, like maybe once a month, maybe less than that, but he would apply for jobs that he knew he was qualified for and had no intent on taking, just so he could go do the interview, do the test, do the screening, whatever it was, just to make sure that he, as he was getting older, was still capable of getting these jobs. And I think that was like a really, you know, I'm not saying everyone's got the time and the flexibility to do that, but I think it is always good to keep in the back of your mind hey, how's my CV doing? Can I still get a job? Is 2013 me the same as 2020 me? Because a lot of people who are stuck in a job or kind of at the grind don't think to kind of, hey, how have I changed in the last few years? Am I more employable? You probably are, you know?
At any point during this, have you thought to yourself, gee, I really wish someone had talked to me when I was younger about what freelancing is and how to pay taxes as a freelancer and any of that stuff? Because I'm super not fascinated is the wrong word because it makes everyone that I talk to sound like a science experiment. And I'm not sure how I feel about that. Yeah. But I feel like I know so many people who do work this way, and nobody has ever been prepared for how do you manage financially that way. I know that taxation is different in the UK than it is in the US, but still, like, have you ever thought to yourself, like, damn, I wish there was just like a quick class that you could take online that explains, like, this is how you manage being a freelancer and not having to pay the government like an astronomical amount of money when tax season comes around?
I mean, over here in the UK, I feel there are a lot of good free resources, citizens advice, etc., where you can find these things out. I think I'm quite fortunate in the sense that I was doing this job on the side while I was still working as a full-time secondary school teacher for a number of years, for instance. All those other jobs I was talking about, you know, I was at one point or another making some money on the side. So, you know, one of the very first things we did for the ITR podcast, because we didn't want to like charge for the podcast and Patreon didn't exist when we first started, we did like a commentary track that we gave away because we had a bust mic and we wanted to get a new microphone and we were all poor as fuck. So we're like, look, we'll do this thing. It's $5 online. If you can get that, we'll buy a new microphone. And we did. We got that and we bought a new microphone. And there was a bit of money that was set aside in a fund, which is like, right, well, we knew that Billy and Adam might be moving away. So we needed to set aside money to have for kind of travel and hotels and hostels. Fun fact, folks, the last third of the first season of the Attitude Era podcast was mostly recorded either in Joe's dead grandmother's house, the room where her grandmother died, or in a hostel in Bristol where the three of us shared a bed, like we were in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. So we very early, we had like a little bit of money, but I'm talking about like this is a couple of $100. And of course, me being a nervous Nelly and my mum and dad, who didn't really understand why I was doing, they're like, declare it. You go to the taxman right now because you are not getting in trouble with the revenue. You are not going to go through that. Go and get it sorted. So I did my own taxes the first few years where it's like, okay, well, we sold one thing, which is this, and that, there we go. How much tax do I have to pay? And, you know, that was kind of it. Like, I had very kind of like babyish trial runs of like, I have a little money. I can do the little bit of tax on top of my normal job where they take care of the tax. But later on, it got like when it became full time, it just became complicated. I couldn't do it on my own. So I just went and I found an accountant. That's it. You know, I pay an accountant to look after my affairs because, and I mean, I take a hit from that every month and every year I take a hit from it as well. And I have to budget accordingly. I sure as sugar like to have that money myself. But the money that guy probably saves me and the fact that he understands what I can claim expenses on and, you know, how to actually file the taxes in a correct way. If there is any issue, he can sort it. So I spend a long time trying to, the problem is though, I'm not going to say the solution is go find a tax guy or go find an accountant, because I had an accountant who was really bad for my first year. And I think I learned a lot more from having a bad accountant than having this good one, because the bad accountant made me realize what I needed to have in a financial advisor, because the guy was not looking after my affairs in a way I was happy with. And I think a lot of freelancers will struggle with that. A lot of freelancers don't get taken seriously by accountants and people in the financial sector because they're like, well, you're not a proper business. You're not like, you don't have employees. You don't have, you know, staff to pay and pensions and yada yada. So you're not important. But yeah, it can be a bit overwhelming. And all I would say is defer to people with expertise when you can. And it was different when it was me on my own, but when it's me and Joe together and we're both doing this, and it's like, hey, we both need to kind of worry about the future and putting stuff away and making sure our affairs are in order. You know, I don't want to be like, I know people who are like, fuck it, man, I've made some money. I don't care what the government thinks. And then they get, you know, fines of thousands and thousands of pounds. You know, we're grown-ups, folks. We have to look after the money properly. And if there is a genuine sense in America and the UK and abroad, beyond, that there aren't resources for freelancers, well, then it needs to get sorted and people need to start sharing those resources, because I think there is stuff out there. And I think a lot of freelancers wouldn't necessarily know what applies to them and what doesn't. And I know in the UK, it can be very complex between being a sole trader or a limited company or a partnership. You know, it can be quite confusing. So, you know, do yourself a great service. Make a friend who is good at that, because we all had a friend who was good at computers, didn't we, to make sure that we had our VPNs installed and all that jazz. So make a friend in the financial services who could do the same for your taxes.
And talk about these things too. I think so many people,
yeah,
we've all been brought up to be like, oh, we don't talk about money. Don't ever talk about money. And it's just kind of like, who is that beneficial to? Not me, for certain, you know. No. Nobody knows, like, how do you decide how much you're worth when it comes to a freelancing project? I was just talking about this on a recent episode with a woman who does graphic design in the esports world. And she was like, yeah, I had no idea how much money I was supposed to be asking until I just started talking to people about it. And that's why when people who are newer come to me, I try to be honest with them, because that's the only way you're ever gonna know whether or not someone's taking advantage of you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Joe goes through this as well, the whole kind of the negotiating of rates and stuff like that. And like the amount of times where I've like really hardballed with someone, and then like kind of the way I've worked around it is like I've tried to get Adam a job or Joe a job as well, and it's like, wait, we'll all do it together but for a reduced rate and stuff like that. But it, you know, you gotta be really, really hard with the negotiations, because some people are just so willing to kind of give you nothing and be so happy about that fact, and like not even consider your needs or anything like that. You know, I did a bit of podcast consultancy, you know, over the years, and Joe has as well. And the amount of time where people are like, well, how much would you charge? And I go, well, if you want to talk to me for a few hours, we'll probably be talking like $40 or $50 an hour, because that's a lot of time out of my day. I'm going to give you very bespoke, very good advice from an expert. And then people are like, oh, I thought it'd be free or something. Like, there's a difference between like a friendly tweet where I'll say, here are a couple of ideas to help you generally, and me sitting down and going through your entire back catalog and then giving you specific tailored advice from someone who's been in this industry for a while and making a living in it. And I think there is a lot of that around, particularly, you know, with freelancers, and I think with podcasters as well, is that like, oh, well, you know, you know, there's an assumption that there's limited to no value in anything you can give. So therefore, people will happily and gleefully give you nothing sometimes for work and whatnot. And I've been really interested just looking at the different worlds where the attitude to freelancers can change. Because I've done some stuff recently for some companies, and I'm like, I'll tell them my rate and I'll tell them I want expenses. And they're like, yeah, great, absolutely fine. And there's, you know, there's small little boutique agencies who would like take, you know, the people I've worked with recently, they take me out to lunch, and it's like, it doesn't seem like the biggest deal in the world, but it's like, you take me out to lunch, you've saved me so much time and money today. I can spend another hour with my partner because I don't have to take care of that. You know, things like that mean so much. And I've worked for huge companies, massive agencies, and Jesus Christ, like they'd absolutely begrudge you like anything. They'd begrudge paying you anything at all if they could get away with it. And I just, you never, like, I wouldn't want to say to give any blanket advice to folks, because I've worked with like groups and people of different sizes and means, and the attitude is always so different. And I think when it comes to freelancing, employers have very different experiences and therefore very different attitudes towards you as a freelancer.
What would you hope that someone who's listening to this podcast right now would take away?
I mean, I never viewed myself as being like a particularly inspirational story or anything like that, but like, you know, when you asked me earlier what would be like something you wish someone had said to you or something like that, it made me thinking like, oh, if I could go to myself when I was in the middle of thinking about, you know, quitting that research job and going out into the wild blue yonder, you know, what would I tell them? Would I say, don't worry, it'll be fine, you know, or like, you know, you should definitely do this, you should be excited. And I was thinking, no, I wouldn't want to tell myself anything. And I was so determined to do things on this certain way in a certain path. And I had this in my head that things had to go a certain way. I had to do this by this age. I was so obsessed in my 20s about doing things before I was 30. I would wake up in the middle of the night in tears going, Jesus Christ, if I don't get my teacher training degree next year, I'll be 29 when I become a teacher. I'll be so old. Woo-hoo-hoo. And like, my main advice to anyone listening to this is like, I don't want to say, don't worry, chill out, but like, allow yourself to accept that you have very little control over this world. And I think where we're sitting at the moment in the current quarantine and whatnot, you never know what's going to happen in life. good things are going to happen, bad things are going to happen. I've told you about all these, you know, fabulous opportunities I've got to have and all these great things that have happened since I've become full-time freelancer, full-time podcaster. You know, I didn't tell you about how I had to get dragged to court, you know, when I first started doing this because a police officer, when I was in a car accident, claimed that I didn't have a license, even though I had a license from Ireland, but he thought that didn't count, which it did. So I had to go to court and spend £1,000 on a lawyer to get the charge dropped of driving without a license, what? Which is very serious. You know, I didn't tell you about that. I didn't tell you about when Joe and I moved into our house, where we've lived here now for 2 years, that we had a massive electrical rewire because the house was very dangerous and we had to spend a month and spend, you know, thousands of pounds getting a whole new electrics put into the house. You know, lots of unfortunate things have happened to me along the way. They didn't happen to me because of the choices I made. They didn't happen to me because of the planning I did and all that. I'm not saying don't plan, and I'm not saying just close your eyes and live with it, but like, there's a lot to be taken from Office Space of just kind of, okay, shit's going on around you, but you just kind of focus on you. Are you happy? You check in with yourself. I can say that with all those things that have happened to me, I'm the happiest I've ever been in years, and I'm very grateful for my happiness. And I think that's the most important thing to focus on. If people can kind of take anything away from this, it's that life will probably not go the way that you plan. There will be ups and there will be downs. All you can do is be your kind of best self and hope that you can roll with whatever punches come your way. Because if I sat down, you know, I've probably touched on only a half of the things that I've done in the last 10 years. And the Kevin who was sitting looking at moon bears in China is very different to the Kevin who was delivering mail while really needing a piss in Lincolnshire, who's very different to the Kevin who was a teacher for 3 years, who's very different to the Kevin who's now podcasting for 4. I couldn't have planned any of this, but that's just the way it is. I don't know what comes next. I can't plan. They're going to ask me what's going to happen in 5 years. I don't know, you know, but like, I'm just going to prepare, save my money, work hard, hustle for every cent, and do the best I can. That's all you can do, you know. It's hard being a freelancer. It certainly is. And there are trade-offs for this freedom that we enjoy. And I think once you recognize the freedoms that you enjoy as a freelancer are very often worth not having to answer to the boss or to be on that grind or to be on that commute. You know, there are positives here. There's a reason you're freelancing probably. So always think about those and be grateful for what little bit of joy you get from choosing to live your life this way.
Where can people find you on the internet? I know there are so many places.
Big deep breath here now, Jay. I'm Kevin Mahon on Instagram and on Twitter. That's Kevin with an F. No, I'm not doing that for attention or to be silly or to annoy people who tweet me constantly telling me that my name is spelled incorrectly. I was a teacher for 3 years while doing the Attitude Era podcast and Cinema Swirl. You think I wanted those kids to find that out? No, I put an F in there. And guess what, Jay? It worked. It absolutely worked. One time in my entire career, and I've taught in 4 different schools over 3 years, one time a kid clocked it, and it was when I appeared on Wrestling with Regret, and he went, "You know Brian Zane?" So I was like, yeah, I'm a pretty big fucking deal. I know Brian Zane. So yeah, I'm Kevin Mahon with an F on Twitter. I'm on Facebook as well. I'm on Instagram. Instagram's a great place to find me now because Joe has introduced me to Instagram stories because I'm 10 years behind everyone. So I put up little clips on editing stuff along the way. Attitude Air Podcast at AE Podcast on Twitter. You can find that where all good podcasts are found except for Spotify. How To Wrestling, the introductory guide to the world of professional wrestling. That's at howtowrestling.com for all information. And Cinema Swirl with my good buddy OTP Sam Chaplin. That is again found on Spotify, iTunes, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. And all of those have Patreons with individual reward tiers and individual pieces of content, all very separate, all go to help different people, different costs and all that. So yeah, there's various means and ways to support me. And hey, I'm always up for a chat. If you ever want to chat on Twitter or any of those places, drop me a line. You want to talk about freelancing, podcasting, anything like that, I can help out, you know, within reason, of course. I can't live your life for you.
Well, thank you, Kevin, for coming on and talking. This has been really wonderful. And I'm still awake. It's amazing. I don't know how, but you're just really interesting.
Yeah, I'm on the proverbial second cup of coffee is what I am, you know. I'm there to help you through the morning. Now, this has been absolutely fascinating, and I really, really appreciate having an opportunity to talk about some kind of different things and talk about this kind of this whole world and this backdrop in which I kind of find myself in. So yeah, I think this is a really useful guide and tool, and I think a lot of people get a lot from this podcast, Jay, and I think it's really important that people hear these different perspectives. And I hope that I have been able to answer your questions in a way that has provided some insight, or at least such little insight that it is of comedic value.
I think you fall somewhere directly in the middle. How does that sound?
Yes. Yeah, okay, no okay. Value whatsoever.
For any listener who hasn't caught on yet that I am a wrestling fan, I would like to assume after the last few episodes, perhaps you have come to that realization. While I'm sure many fellow fans are feeling a bit at odds with that fandom at the minute, I just want to encourage everyone to seek out the things in life that bring them joy and that allow them to immerse themselves in another world, whether it's reading, music, film, or television. That bit of escapism is so important right now. We all need a break from time to time, even if it's just an hour-long podcast. If you'd like to hear more episodes with friends I've met through wrestling, check out episode 1 with Courtney the Librarian, episodes 3 and 4 with Mike the Carer, episode 12 with Justine the Self-Starter, and episode 24 with Henry the Appreciator. If you'd like to chat or maybe be on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter at The Lady J Says and on Instagram at The Lady J Slays. Be sure you subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your auditory escapism and never miss any future episodes, like next week's chat with a friend of mine from the West Coast. I'll see you then. Bye.